This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
So the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter. And the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter faster. Until you move into a process that is completely uncontrollable.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Radio EcoShock. We are just beginning to understand why the sudden meltback of the Arctic sea ice could change the climate of the world. If you live in the Northern Hemisphere, your own weather has already changed because of it. This may not be pleasing holiday fare, but our time together is limited and valuable. Critically important news, I can't let it go unreported, no matter what the local tragedy is that's dominating the mainstream headlines. As we will hear in this program, there is enough methane buried in the Arctic to drive us into an extinction event from runaway climate change. It could be beyond our ability to adapt. I'm going to talk at length with Paul Beckwith. He's trained in engineering and physics, but is now working on his PhD in climate science at the University of Ottawa. I also know Paul as part of a group of scientists and activists called the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, or AMEG. You can find my earlier interview with one of AMEG's senior scientists, Arctic ice expert specialist Dr. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge University. That's in the Radio EcoShock show February 15, 2012. I also interviewed critics of this theory that methane from melting permafrost and shallow northern seabeds poses an immediate emergency for the planet.
Oh my God! Breaking up!
I'm also going to present for the first time a radio adaptation from a new movie by the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. You will hear from Dr. Wadhams, but also from James Hansen, the NASA super scientist, plus Natalia Shakova, a Russian scientist now working at the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and from David Wasdale, founder of the Apollo Gaia Project. In my blog at ecoshock.info, you can find a link to my past Radio EcoShock interview with David Wasdale in our December 10, 2010 show called Beyond the Tipping Point. It's really worth a listen if you missed it. As you heard in our recent programs, the possibility of staying below the alleged safety point of 2 degrees Celsius temperature has more or less passed away. Reports from the World Bank, the International Energy Agency, accountants PricewaterhouseCoopers, the United Nations, and many more show that the world is headed to at least a 4-degree warming by 2100, if not sooner, unless space aliens come to save us or unless we finally wake up and take immediate action. The year 2012 has been the hottest in instrumental records, hotter than the previous tide records of 1998 and 2005. According to Joe Rome at thinkprogress.org, quote, the very warm November and early December assures record-breaking 2012, end quote. Weathermeister Jeff Masters from the Weather Underground writes, the year-to-date period of January to November has been by far the warmest such period on record for the contiguous U.S., a remarkable 1 degree Fahrenheit above the previous record, end quote. Not coincidentally, and despite all the expense of international climate conferences, world greenhouse gas emissions are not dropping, but rising steeply year on year. The Global Carbon Project, which measures such things, finds global emissions in 2012 set a new all-time record. That's very discouraging news. In 2012, we pumped out an eye-popping 58% more greenhouse gases than the world did in 1990. I'm going to play you a short clip from Corinne LeQuaire. She's a professor of climate change science and policy at the University of East Anglia in the UK, and she's the director of the prestigious British climate modelling agency, the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. This is a short audio from a film clip at the Tyndall Centre site.
Our latest study with the Global Carbon Project shows that the carbon emission from burning fossil fuel are set to increase again in 2012 to a record high of 35.7 billion tons of CO2. And it means that the global emissions now are 58% above the level they were in year 1990, the reference year for the International Kyoto Protocol. Contributors to global carbon emissions in 2011 were China with 28%, the United States with 16%, the European Union with 11%, and India with 7%. The 2012 rise in carbon emission further opens the gap between the real world emissions and those that are required to keep global climate change under 2 degrees, which is the international agreement. If the carbon emissions continue the way they are leading to climate change of 4 degrees and above. We, the scientific community, were often asked what a 4-degree world would look like, because after all, we have seasons and day and night, so 4 degree really sometimes doesn't really feel like very much. But actually, I think that we globally, we might be able to say with some confidence what 1, 2, and perhaps 3 degree looks like. But when you start looking at changes of 4, 5, and 6 degrees, is really out of bounds of anything that we've experienced in the recent past. And so these are really, really big changes in the way that the Earth operates. Nice. But we're talking about warming changes that that are really enormous in the climate system, and it's difficult to say what this is going to look like, what kind of vegetation transitions we will have, what kind of changes in the soils where we grow our food, ice and melt, what does that do for instance, the weather patterns and for the changes in extreme events.
That was from the Tyndall Center, Corinne LeQuaire. Warming will impact the whole world, not just the Northern Hemisphere. Graham Redfern, a correspondent for ABC Broadcasting in Australia, tried to look at what that country could experience in a 4-degree hotter world. His article came out December 10th, 2012. Find a link to it in my blog at ecoshock.info or at my source, climatechangepsychology.blogspot.ca. For example, quote, in 2008, work by CSIRO found that if there was no action to cut global emissions, the number of days each year over 35 degrees centigrade experienced in Australia's capital cities would jump dramatically. For example, Darwin gets about 9 degrees a year over 35 degrees C, but by 2070, this was projected to rise to 221 days. More than half the year would be above 35 degrees centigrade. Melbourne would go from 9 days to 21 days above 35 degrees C, and Sydney from 3 to 9, end quote. From ABC Australia, there are similar projections for America. Most cities in the U.S., and especially in the South, would be sweltering through unbelievable heat waves, and that would be the new normal for summer. ABC Australia's Redfern continues, quote, Professor Jean Palukatoff, director of the government-funded National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility, believes an Australia 4 degrees warmer than today will be a very different place. Quote, it would be just too unpleasant to be out of doors, she says. People would be living far more enclosed lives. It would be a heavily energy-dependent existence, as you have to cool off all those spaces where you put people into. You would have to be running your air conditioners as a matter of course. The huge challenge would be to lay our hands on the energy we would need to maintain our comfort levels, end quote, from ABC Australia. And believe me, with peak oil and the dirtier and dirtier hard energy sources we're turning to already, I don't think we'd keep those air conditioners running. And never mind the disappearing coral reefs, all the ice and snow gone, forest burning and burning, and mass extinctions of animals, plants, and insects. We've just talked about 2012 setting a new record for greenhouse gas emissions. The Global Carbon Project measures only emissions from fossil fuels and not things like deforestation or agricultural emissions. And they certainly don't measure, as the International Government Panel on Climate Change does not measure, the methane emissions coming from the Arctic that we will discuss in this program. A new report released in late November by the United Nations Environment Program says the IPCC must report on melting permafrost and methane, including a special report if needed. Yet I've spoken by email with some IPCC reviewers who assure me the Arctic methane emergency is not included in the upcoming IPCC reports coming out in 2013 and 2014. Again, this intergovernmental agency is not just way beyond the actual science, but it's late, late, late on climate change as we know to be happening already.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Let us hear what the Arctic Methane Emergency Group has to say in their new film, Arctic Methane, Why the Sea Ice Matters. This compilation of experts includes Dr. Peter Wadhams of Cambridge University, NASA scientist James Hansen, Natalia Shakova from the International Arctic Research Center at the University of Alaska, and David Wasdell, founder of the Apollo Gaia Project. The short film was put together by Nick Breeze and Brew Pierce of the new climate communication group called Envisionation. We start with Peter Wadhams, who has been measuring and exploring Arctic ice for decades. He is president of the International Association for the Physical Sciences of the Ocean Commission on Sea Ice, and he heads up the Polar Ocean Physics Group at Cambridge University in England.
Well, there's something happening now that really hasn't happened before, and it is very important and quite urgent that we recognise what's going on. That is that the ice has been getting thinner as over the last 40 years since I've been measuring it, and it's now lost about half of its thickness. So the average thickness of ice in the Arctic now is about half what it was 30 years ago. Big change. And so far it hasn't shown itself in a collapse of the ice cover, but it will very soon, because you can't keep thinning something off for a long time without it in the end collapsing. What's been happening is that the ice cover's been shrinking slowly, a few percent per decade, and so the whole Arctic Ocean is covered with ice in the winter. Then in the summer it shrinks back a little bit, and if you're lucky you can sail around the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route, but just via some narrow slot. But then about 5 years ago, the shrinkage started to accelerate, and now in the summer we have a huge area of open water in the middle of the Arctic, enough that you can see it on a satellite picture and the Earth looks blue at the top end instead of white. And that shrinkage is because the thinning of the ice is causing it to break up more readily in the summer. And in fact, what's happening now is that the melt in the summer is greater than the growth in the winter. So all the ice that grows during the winter will melt the following summer. So you will have a summer Arctic which is actually ice-free. And this will come about very soon at the rate we're going. If you extrapolate what's going on now for thickness, it'll bring us to an ice-free summer Arctic in about 4 years' time. So already we should be seeing something drastic happening probably this summer.
Now we go to Dr. James Hansen, director of the Goddard Space Institute for Space Studies, NASA.
Well, the Arctic is warming faster than most places on the planet. And that's partly because of the sea ice, because as we begin to lose some of the sea ice, it exposes the darker ocean, which absorbs more sunlight, and it causes the ocean to warm further and melt more ice. There are potential irreversible effects of melting the sea ice. If it begins to allow the Arctic Ocean to warm up and warm the ocean floor, then we'll begin to release methane hydrates. And if we let that happen, that's a potential tipping point that we don't want to pass.
David Wasdell, founder of the Apollo Gaia Project.
Well, it's in many places, but frozen methane is what we call clathrates or hydrates, which is a form of methane gas interlaced with water molecules in a certain sludgy form of ice. It's been formed by biological processes over many millions of years, and it's stored in the ocean sediment, the bottom particularly of the shallow oceans, north of the European continent and the North American continent, so the Canadian continental shelf and the Siberian continental shelf. Very rich deposits of methane held in the sedimental areas. But remember, those areas have been subject to ice ages, and we have fossil ice in the seabed left over from the ice ages, which has masked great deposits of methane underneath that frozen layer, as well as more recent methane in clathrate form above the fossil ice. So it's a big store, about three times, we think, the amount of hydrocarbons stored in the methane deposits, both in the shallow seas and also to some extent in the tundra on land, than the totality of oil, coal, and gas deposits on the planet. Huge amount.
Natalia Shakova from the International Arctic Research Center.
So I would say that we started investigation the methane issue in the Arctic in 90s of the last century, and we started from the terrestrial ecosystem, freshwater ecosystem, and then about 8 years ago switched to studying the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. And actually we've been studying it for the last 8 years, continuously, year by year by year, conducting one or two expeditions a year. And if, for example, a few years ago we could reach the certain sites from the fast ice. Fast ice is annual ice. And we can reach quite easily to certain sites, hundreds or tens of kilometers from the coast. But last 2 years we couldn't do that because the ice was broken. It was polynias, it was brines, it was leads. So that means that, and where the sea ice should be about 2 meters thick, it was 40 centimeters thick. That means that the processes, the sort of destabilization of everything, of the sea ice, of the water column, of the currents increasing, the movement of water beneath the sea ice increased. So everything looks anomalous.
James Hansen?
Well, there are now observations that methane is beginning to be released by both melting tundra on the land and bubbling up in the Arctic Ocean, indicating some warming of the Arctic Ocean.
Here is Peter Wadhams again.
One of the big effects is already happening, and I think the most important effect is the fact that with the sea ice already retreating in the summer, this slot of open water has become a very large expanse, and that open water absorbs so much radiation during the summer months that it warms up. So instead of sitting there at the freezing point like it used to do, it now warms up to about 5 degrees. And 5 degrees is very warm by Arctic standards. And that amount of heat in the water is enough to start warming up the seabed, because the retreat is happening over the continental shelves where the water is shallow. And so the seabed's warming up, and the seabed at the moment is frozen. It's offshore permafrost, an extension of the permafrost on land out under the sea. But when you're warming that up to 5 degrees every summer, it's now starting to melt and the permafrost is disappearing. And what that's doing is allowing a lot of methane, which is trapped under the permafrost, to be released. It's trapped as methane hydrates at the moment, but as soon as you melt the permafrost, it turns back into methane and bubbles up. So for the last 2 or 3 years, there's been a joint Russian-Alaskan expedition going out into the Siberian Sea and observing this, and they've been seeing great plumes of methane bubbling up all over the East Siberian Sea. The whole zone of millions of square miles of territory is now releasing all of its methane cover. And that's a large boost to global warming, because methane is an extremely powerful climatically active gas. It's about 23 times as powerful as carbon dioxide per molecule.
And David Wasdell.
I think the relationship between the behaviour of sea ice and the behaviour of the release of methane in the Arctic is very important. As temperature goes up, and it has reached an increase of about 3 degrees already over the pre-industrial temperature in the Arctic, it's warming faster than any other place on the planet. Lots of things start happening together, and it's the combination of these processes that is so important to grasp. Not only do you have less sea ice near to the coast, so the coastal waters are warming, but you have warming of the tundra, thawing of the tundra, the permafrost areas on the continental near coastal area. So the water running off from that comes in as warm, fresh water. So that warms the shallow seas over the continental shelf and pushes the sea ice further back. That means that that whole area of the ocean is now open to wave energy, storm energy, tidal energy, mixing down. So that the warm water from the surface is now being mixed down to those areas that it never reached while the whole area was covered in sea ice. So as soon as the area is open water, you have a process of heating that goes right down to those clathrate deposits on the seabed. They will then, instead of just releasing slowly and getting absorbed under the ice, start bubbling up through the surface of the water into the atmosphere. And the more the methane is released into the atmosphere, because it's a greenhouse gas, the more energy is retained from the solar input, and the faster the heating goes, which increases the rate of ice movement, decreases the area of the snowfields, increases the heat of the runoff, increases the heating in the ocean, increases the rate of methane, which increases the warming, which increases the rate of methane. And you have this feedback process setting off.
You are listening to a Radio EcoShock adaptation from the short film Arctic Methane, Why the Sea Ice Matters, prepared for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group in late 2012 by Invisia Nation. The next speaker is Natalia Shakova from the University of Alaska.
This particular sediment layer, which is 53 meters, doesn't seal this methane escaping from the seabed deposits any longer. It provides us with gas migration pathways. This is what is the significance of this.
David Wasdell from the Apollo Gaia Project.
I think we're all used to feedback systems in many processes of life. I'm sure you've been in a public hall with a public address system running and somebody on the sound system has turned the amplifier up too much and the output from the loudspeakers goes into the microphone and you get into a howl and everybody goes, oh, turn that off. Well, that's where feedback gets into the system and increases the signal. Lots of things in the climate that we have on Earth do that. Now, the distinction between just a feedback process and a runaway feedback process is very, very important indeed. You can have feedback that slowly increases, if you like, the risk and puts the temperature up a bit higher. Runaway feedback says the system responds so much to increased in temperature that it becomes faster in the way it changes the climate with rising temperature. So the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter. And the hotter it gets, the faster it gets hotter faster. Until you move into a process that is completely uncontrollable. And instead of coming up to a new equilibrium temperature, maybe a bit high, it goes on going up faster and faster until something runs out. There's no more methane to release, or we've run out of forests to burn or something, or there's no more ice to melt, and so that there's no more reflection feedback going on. The danger of moving into a runaway climate change scenario is now clear and is beginning to be quantified for the first time in the last few months. It's probably the greatest threat that we face as a planet.
Natalia Shakova.
So the methane in the atmosphere, the total amount of methane in the atmosphere, in the current atmosphere, it's about 5 gigatons. The amount of carbon preserved in form of methane in the Siberian Arctic Shelf is approximately from hundreds to thousands of gigatons. And of course, it's only 1% of that amount is required to double the atmospheric burden of methane. But to destabilize 1% of this carbon pool, I think it's not much effort needed, considering that the state of permafrost and the amount of methane currently involved. Because what divides this methane from the atmosphere is a very shallow water column and a weakening permafrost, which is losing its ability to seal, to serve as a seal. Just because this area is very seismically and tectonically active, and there was some investigation that the tectonic activity is increasing, and the seismic activity is, what is seismic activity? It's destabilization of these grounds. It's just mechanical forcing destabilization. So it's additional pathways for this methane to be escaped. We do not like what we see there. Absolutely do not like.
Peter Wadhams from Cambridge.
The other thing, of course, is climatic instability, that with an open Arctic, you're going to have many more events like just we've had in the last few weeks of outbreaks of cold air in places you don't expect. Large instabilities in the atmosphere, and which will affect agricultural production. So we think, you sort of think you're going to gain from global warming in that it gets warmer, you can grow more crops, you can grow crops further north in Canada and Siberia, and that's true, but also the instability means that at critical times those crops are going to be affected by frost or floods or rain. And the estimates are that actually you won't gain much from the warming in the northern hemisphere, and you will lose a lot, of course, from the warming in all the tropical regions, which is really going to have a very serious effect on agricultural production. So there's the global warming impact on agriculture is going to be very serious, and it's going to be difficult to see how to support even the present world population.
James Hansen?
I think that the concept of adapting to the climate change is really a dangerous one, because there is the potential for climate effects which humanity practically cannot adapt to. If the ice sheets become unstable and sea level goes up multi-meters and eventually tens of meters, well, you're going to put all of the cities on coasts all around the world underwater, and you will destroy all of that heritage. So we don't want that to happen. That's the economic consequences of that are so enormous. It makes no sense to talk about adaptation to that. And likewise, if we burn all the fossil fuels, then we certainly will cause the methane hydrates eventually to come out and cause several degrees more warming. And it's not clear that civilization could survive that extreme climate change.
David Wasdell.
The rate of change that we're generating in the current situation is between 200 and 300 times faster than that experienced in any of the extinction events apart from the asteroidal impact. If you look at the general background change, for instance, it takes about 10,000 years to change the concentration of carbon dioxide by about 100 parts per million. We're doing it in 30 years at this year's rate. So the rate of change in the climate is phenomenal compared to previous extinction events. We are already in a mass extinction event. It isn't something that's going to happen in the future. We are now losing species and losing populations, partly by climate change, partly by habitat change, and partly by over-exploitation of habitats and fisheries, for instance. We've lost about 40% of the phytoplankton in the ocean, which is the base of the food chain, simply because of acidification and temperature change in the climate. This is already a mass extinction event. The question is, how far is it going to go? How serious does it become? And if we are not able to stop the rate of increase of temperature itself and to get that back under control, then a high temperature event, perhaps another 5 or 6 degrees, would obliterate at least as many as 60 to 70 to 80% of the populations and the species of the rest of life on Earth.
And finally, Peter Waters.
Whatever you do as an individual in your personal life is tiny, although it adds up if everybody does it, but what you can do to, say, influence politicians is maybe more important. So your role as a citizen, concerned citizen, is the most important role I think a normal person can adopt.
That was Radio EcoShock adaptation from the short film Arctic Methane, Why the Sea Ice Matters. It was prepared for the Arctic Methane Emergency Group in late 2012 by Invisia Nation. Find links to all this in my blog at ecoshock.info, or check out the Emergency Group website at www.meg.me. That's meg.me. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.